Well, welcome back to Startup Tales from the Treehouse. On this next episode, I have Jim Melpe. Jim is a go-to-market sales expert. He's got over 30 years in the industry. He's had some huge successes. He talks a little bit about being one of the first sales reps at Taleo and their exit to Oracle, as well as his time at Concur, going from maybe $35 billion to over $2 billion in revenue. But this is not about, you know, building scale and talking about large teams. I think it's getting really back to the kind of the fundamentals and what are the elements that really work to build an organization and then scale it over time in the go-to-market space. I thought there was a lot of really good insights, and so I really hope you enjoy this. So just sit back and enjoy this conversation with Jim Melpe. Well, welcome to the podcast today. Today I have Jim Melpe. Jim and I work together at Concur, and then Jim has been helping with some of the mentoring opportunities with Wildfire Labs. So I'm super excited. Jim has a wealth of kind of go-to-market knowledge and experience, and so super happy and excited to have this conversation. So welcome to the podcast, Jim.
Thanks, Todd. Happy to be here.
Good. Well, why don't we start a little bit about your background? So I'm kind of curious about how'd you get into sales? Like, why did that? You went to college, got a business degree, I think. Then maybe just talk a little bit about your background at getting into sales. And then kind of, I know you went to Taleo and you went to Concur. And so you've had some success, but maybe give me a little bit of background on how you got there.
Sure. Yep. So yeah, I graduated college with a marketing degree, and my first 11 years out of school, I actually went and worked for Whirlpool Corporation, and I was in their management trainee program. So I did a wealth of different things. I was in logistics, I was in auditing, I was in marketing, and then I finished up my last 5 years there in sales. So that was kind of my transition into sales. And from there, the kind of tech storm was coming in 1997, 98. I wanted to get into technology. And I didn't have any technology background, so I actually went and worked for a company called Scantron for 2 years just to get my feet wet in tech. And that was a great learning cycle. And from there, we had the dot-com boom starting. And I went to work for a pure startup. I was one of the, I was in the founding sales team prior to product launch, a company, it was called RecruitSoft at the time. And then we ended up changing the name to Taleo. It was a recruitment platform. And that was a great run. I was there 7 years. We took it from zero revenue to roughly $80 million and got it public. And then it eventually got acquired by Oracle for $1.8 billion. So I did a very wide range of jobs there, starting in sales. And at the end of the tenure, I was running sales and the client group across the Americas at the end. So it was a great run. I got to see kind of how the sausage was made from the beginning and how to make sure that it scaled up over time. So that was, it was dog years, that's for sure.
And then you just pivoted into more dog years at Concur?
Yeah, well, you know what? I was burned out. And for you people who are spinning up new companies, I first congratulate you because it's going to be the hardest and most rewarding thing you ever did, but it's certainly going to be the hardest. And after that 7 years getting it public, I was tired. And I decided I wanted to go back and get to something that was a little less hectic and get my feet back under me and reintroduce myself to my family, which had kind of had a child that was 5 years old at that time that was a blur. And so I went to Concur, which was a travel or an expense reporting platform. It seemed like a pretty safe bet. But little did I know that right after I joined them at $38 million. And right after I joined them, they basically shifted the entire paradigm in that industry. And we went on a run over the next 10 to 12 years and ran it up to over $1 billion in revenue. And we eventually got acquired by SAP for $8.3 billion. So what I thought I was finding a landing spot, I just jumped on another kind of
rocket ship.
Yeah. And that was a great run. I joined them as one of four sales directors in the U.S. And I retired from SAP Concur in this past September. And at that time, it's roughly $2 billion in revenue. I had about $1 billion of that in my organization. I was running, I was the GM for the Americas. So I had all go-to-market rolling up to me. So it was quite a run. And then I took a couple months and decided I wanted to get back to my roots, which was more mentoring, selling, being closer to the business. And so I started just a little consulting company, and wanted to go work with, you know, early life startup companies. And that's where I am today.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. You know, stepping on two rocket ships during your career and then, you know, really catching the brass ring on that doesn't happen very often, Jim. So congratulations. That's pretty impressive. And, you know, there's a lot of great experiences in there. So maybe pivoting a little bit to kind of, what do you think? So if we think about where you're at today, and what are the foundational blocks to really thinking about sales, right? So if you got a small company or somebody who's just starting and they're getting ready, my product's ready to go to market, you know, you hear a lot of stuff about persona, you hear a lot of stuff about discovery and pain digging. Like, what do you think some of those like elemental blocks are that they, like an entrepreneur or an early stage company, should really be thinking about?
Yeah, it's a good question. I actually think, you know, in hindsight, I would start probably three steps even before that.
Okay.
Because generally, and I found this out at Taleo, and I certainly found it out at Concur when we made the pivot to travel and expense. Generally speaking, a startup organization is coming out with a product that, in a lot of cases, the market didn't know they needed. You know, think of Apple. Nobody really thought they needed what Apple came out with, and they created a market for it. It was very similar with Taleo and Concur, where people didn't think they needed their expense reporting platform to do travel. So some of the mistakes that were made, I made at both the companies, which I encourage as entrepreneurs start doing their market assessment, is figuring out who they're going to sell to, and understand that in many of the cases there's going to be disintermediation in play, and just because the product you're coming out with has a stakeholder base, a traditional stakeholder base, that may not be the stakeholder base that you should be focused on trying to sell. I'll give you an example. So when we were at RecruitSoft Taleo, the first our first stakeholder base they went after is the recruiters are going to love this tool because it does all this sorting and it does dimensions. It does all this stuff that they're just going to love. Well, what we found out was the recruiters didn't like it because they thought it was going to replace them.
Yep.
And we had to do a 180-degree pivot to find stakeholders that it resonated with and figure out how we could just, you know, keep the recruiters, you know, neutral at best. But it set us back 6 to 8 months. Wow. Just because we didn't account for that. We were so excited about what it could do. We forgot that the people side of it didn't come into the equation. And honestly, Todd, you probably, you know, with Concur, we did the same thing. Initially, we thought, oh, my travel managers are going to love this. Well, yep. They became the biggest dissenters of our value proposition, even though it was squarely in their world. And we didn't do a great job of recognizing that. So
I think there's even another dimension to that where it's like even finding the user that's excited about it, but they're not the ones that sign the checks, right? And so the contracts.
Exactly.
And so same sort of deal where it's like there's just a discontinuation of here's the person that's getting the value, but there's somebody else that's going to sign off on the budget. And then again, that becomes like, who are we actually selling to?
Yep. And finding that economic buyer is really important. I was doing some consulting over the past year with a company that was selling an HR product that was great for COVID because it was trying to tie, you know, all the people in their basement into a community. And some of my feedback to them was, well, this is great, but I don't see a clear economic buyer. HR in this case, probably not going to be able to buy it. You're going to have to reframe the problem a bit to get some economic buyers in that actually hold budgets. And, and that's what I encourage all entrepreneurs to try to figure out at this point as they're bringing stuff to market is who's truly the target market. You know, how are you going to reframe the problem to where there's an economic buyer that makes sense? And then once you kind of have that figured out, then you start building out your personas and tying, you know, the value prop to them. I mean, people buy. I had a very wise mentor once, and he told me 20 years ago, people buy for three reasons. They buy if they're in trouble, if they see trouble coming, or they want to be a hero. And I've lived by that, and it's really, really true. So as you start putting your personas together and your value props together, you know, I always use that as my guiding light. So how do I tie it to that? Because I guarantee you, if you do a good job there and you do a good job making sure that the personas are the right setup, you're going to put yourself in a much better position to be successful.
Okay, but what about, I guess one other piece that I think I've seen, we did it at Concur quite a bit, which is just discovery and just understanding pain. And then you see a lot of startups that go to, I'm just going to show you every feature in the book, right? I'm going to just product sell you, and I'm not solving a solution. And so what about that kind of position? Because I think that's one of the more important things that I took away from Concur was like, what problem are you solving? And really holding back even on the demo side to say, we're not going to show it to you until I understand what problem you want to solve, because there's some sense of urgency there to you.
Yeah, it gets back to, and I see this at the startups a lot more, is because in that first year or two, out of necessity, your founders are the ones, or your R&D people are the ones that are doing the demos, they're doing the sales, and they're very excited about what they built. Yeah. And they generally get an audience of somebody senior within the organization they're selling to through networking or whatever. And they've skipped all the other traditional sales steps that are going to have to take place in every other sale. They skip right to the, I'm going to throw up all over you with all the great stuff that I have. And it becomes problematic because you're not finding the economic buyer. You're not truly building a value prop that is addressing either the overt need or the need that you've reframed that they didn't even know they had, right? I mean, when it's done best, you're reframing to a need that they didn't even know they had. But you can't do that unless you've taken the time to understand their business and to have them talk them through, you know, the outcomes of things that have taken place and why they're even talking to you. So you're right. And I think a lot of that comes with founders generally doing the selling early on, because they get the luxury of skipping a lot of the steps. And I've always tried to pull founders back and say, I get it, you get an audience because you're the founder and you love to talk about your product, but you have to build a business. You can't, you know, you have to be able to scale yourself and use best practices. You wouldn't do this if, you know, it was engineering or accounting and you didn't know anything about engineering or accounting, but sales seems kind of easy. So you kind of go and do it. Not to say it's, you know, rocket science, but there is a method to it that is going to increase your opportunity to be successful if you take the time to, you know, understand their needs and go through the discovery and do those things.
So let's just take that word discovery. So like, what would you say, like, I guess, like, I think people intellectually kind of get what you're saying, but like maybe take it down to brass tacks. Like when you're talking to somebody and you're trying to discover like what problem you're trying to go solve. And, you know, one of the things that we always talk about in Wildfire is like, you got to get to those, like, understand what problem they want to solve and then anchor all the way through a demo. But can you give a more concrete example or just a, like a way to talk through this that makes the concept of discovery down to something that's pretty tangible?
Sure. So let me talk about Concur. So I'll use that as an example. So when we would go in and do discovery with Concur, we, depending on who we were talking to, you know, if we were talking to finance, let's say we're talking to finance and we wanted to understand, first of all, did they recognize that, generally speaking, expense, travel and expense is the second largest line item on their P&L.
Yep.
Some cases they did, some cases it was a little bit of an aha, but we'd go through discovery with that because we were trying to lead to an outcome. So we'd ask them, you know, tell us a little bit about kind of, you know, what impacts your P&L? Oh, travel and expense. So how does it impact it? Great. So would having better visibility into line item stuff make a difference, or do you really do it at the, you know, aggregate level? Oh, no, we would love to see that. Okay, that's great. And so we would just keep diving down and then working the pain funnel along with it. Well, how does that impact your business? Well, how does that impact you financially? If that got fixed, how would that change your world? Right. But we did it in a way, and I encourage everybody to do it in a way to where you're setting it up to the outcome that you want. So you know what your product is set up to do. You know what it does well. You know the problems that it, you know, solves in general. So you want to lead your folks in that direction, but you learn so much along the way that you may not even have thought about as well. By taking the time to sit down and understand their business through questioning and having them try to articulate how it impacts them, you know, how financially it's affecting their business, what it would mean if it was actually solved. And if you do that with a cross representation of the stakeholder base, you're going to get a picture that now allows you, when you go to do a demo, that is like you're reading their mind. Right. And I don't know if that answered your question totally, Todd, but it's really, far more than, you know, taking the three things that everybody says could be a problem and then building a demo off it. Like, I'm consulting with a company now and they're, you know, communication and two other generic things. Well, unless you're tying economic, you know, accountability to that and other things, it becomes, you're not going to be able to differentiate yourself from every other competitor in the market. And it's really important that you can find those things that you can differentiate on, yep, especially when you're a startup, because you have to have something to hang your hat on. Yep. And that is done through really good discovery.
So maybe just to recap this piece of it, I think that A, you have to invest some time to understand their business, right? I mean, that's the diligence part of this, where it's like, I'm going to understand enough where I have an idea of where my solution will fit. I think, two, you have to validate this is the problem that they really want to go solve, and then build this kind of custom demo to really solve those problems for them. And so it is kind of a multi-step process, but it starts with not you just throwing up about all the wonderful features you have. It's about, no, I need more intake from you to really understand your business so I understand how to position our product.
Yes. Yes. Okay. And generally speaking, I found people very open to taking the time to do discovery, as long as you give them a good reason to sit down with that and to let them know that the outcome of the demo is going to be far, far more productive for them if they take 30 minutes up front.
Yep. Better use of their time.
And to ask, I mean, you know, a lot of times people are going to say no, but you're going to have to take that extra conversation to explain to them why it's important.
Yeah.
So,
okay, let's pivot a little bit to like just finding those first couple of customers. So kind of our methodology from a wildfire standpoint is you do a bunch of discovery, you interview a bunch of customers, and then we go through kind of building the wireframes. And then we try to get a commitment from a beta perspective that said, if you interviewed 50 of those people, if you can't get half of them to sign up for a beta, and it doesn't have to be paid, just, you know, that they're committed to use your product, then we're going to come back to them. And so then you get them on the beta. And usually what we're finding is at least half of those end up turning into paid customers. So you kind of go through a progression to at least get the first handful of them. You've included them in the process of building something, and then you've kind of taken them along the process to actually show them something of value. And so I'm kind of curious, Jim, from your learnings and kind of what you're doing with other companies, like how do you find those kind of first handful of customers? Is that a reasonable way to kind of look at the first handful, and then you got to start to scale it to get to the next 25?
Yeah, so I think probably with Taleo, we had to go through that process because we didn't have any customers. So, and the way we did it was, we went to a trade show. That's the way we did it. We went to a trade show and we had some presentations at the trade show. And then, you know, as we engage with people at the trade show, we talk to them about being beta customers. And you know, at that time, I think we walked out, it was the Chicago HR Tech Show. We walked out of there with probably 15 customers that agreed to be part of the beta program. Then we went back and interviewed each one of them after the show. And we ended up with two customers that we decided to move forward with. And we really based it on we wanted somebody that was willing, that showed a wonderful willingness to not only have the reward of doing this, but understanding the pain. And maybe they've done it before somewhere, because it takes, you know, it's not always going to be smooth. And we were trying to find customers that had a sensitivity to that, and they were okay with that, and also ones that, you know, like to put themselves out there. So we ended up finding a guy named John Walker at Dow Chemical, and he had a great background both in business and in tech, which was another thing we wanted. He could talk to both sides of the fence really well, and he was very willing to engage across the excuse me, I'm going to sneeze here. across the spectrum of stakeholders. So it was a great fit for us. And that's what I've tried to model as I've worked with other, you know, beta customers. You know, with Concur, we tried to find beta customers for our app partners. And he became my model for everybody we tried to go out and pick. And I think it's important once you find them that you just don't use them on the product. You engage them. You know, we engaged this gentleman heavy with our R&D. It didn't mean we didn't make any commitments that we were going to do it, but we brought him out. And it was Quebec City, Canada at that point, and we sat him down with our R&D team. He talked to him, and he really got a sense of ownership in the business to where he became an advocate without us, you know, having to push him there, just because he had a sense of ownership. So,
you know, another piece to this that I think is dead on, I think, you know, you're getting the personality and the person that can carry the water at the prospect side of it. I think one of the other things that we see is kind of a danger is you go to a trade show and then there's a ton of people that have some interest, but they're like, hey, just add this feature, just add that feature. Or if you did this for me. And so what I think you're describing is saying, okay, I got inquiries from, let's say, 20. Now, really, the ones that actually fit from a product perspective are really only 5 to 7. And then if there's a personality that really can carry this for us, maybe it's only 3 to 4. And so I think having some discipline where you're not just chasing all these different opportunities, and they're not all the same. And I think, you know, when people get entrepreneurs and founders get super excited when they're seeing there's interest in my product, And they're then, I think they get in this whack-a-mole thing where it's like then trying to satisfy everybody that you've signed up. It's just a, it's a losing situation in the short term.
Yeah. It's a, we did a, it's actually not that long ago at Concur. We had a, App Center partner and they went to one of our user conferences and and they ended up getting five or six people to participate, but they didn't, it was ran outside of my group and they signed them all up and it was exactly what you just described. It became, you know, you couldn't satisfy all of them and you couldn't, you know, you would have been an inch deep and a mile wide if you tried to, you know, address their requests and their needs. They finally just killed it because it just didn't work and went back to, let's get disciplined about what we're looking for somebody in this program and then stick to it. And that's what I've seen work the best by far. So,
okay. Maybe one other piece that I kind of forgot to mention too is we talked about product kind of alignment. We talked about kind of prospect alignment, meaning like they can carry water. You talked about them getting into R&D and really helping get a sense of that urgency. One of the other things that we didn't really talk about is just using them as a marketing tool, right? So being able to get quotes for them, doing a testimonial, using them in marketing collateral. I think that's another area where you're kind of looking and saying, out of all these prospects that are raising their hand, which one of these are actually a really good fit? Because I do think that is some of your best material out of the gate. It's not you talking about it. It's a person that's actually getting value from it and agreeing upfront. And depending on where you're selling, I mean, some companies won't do that, right? Some companies will just say, hey, that's not part of our DNA or our culture, or legally, we just can't do it.
Yeah, no, it's hugely important. And back to the RecruitSoft Taleo experience, the gentleman from Dow Chemical, I would say his fingerprints were probably on our first 20 customers. Yeah. I mean, heavy.
They were reference for you and
reference. And, you know, he'd speak at conferences. He would take reference calls. He would, you know, and we let him know that, you know, if something's not right, then you need to talk about that as well. So he was very comfortable that, you know, he didn't have any handcuffs on. And it worked out great. And that's been kind of replicated that at every one of my stops since on a best practice to get something off the ground. So
let's kind of change a little bit. So let's say you got those first handful of customers. You've kind of gone through, I mean, do you think, what's the next path to like getting the next, say, 25 or whatever that happens to be to start to get a path to product market fit? I guess some of the things that I'm thinking about, Jim, are, you know, in this first couple that you're talking about, you're trying out a bunch of different messaging, you're trying out different positioning, you're trying out even persona-wise, you're trying to kind of find this. And then, you know, at some point in time, this gets going from, hey, 50% of the time the work that worked, sometimes it didn't, down to, hey, 85% of the time we're seeing the same pattern and we're kind of walking them through it. So now you're starting to get some predictability. Is this when you start to, like, you know, really build some collateral, start building some sales kind of motion that's got some consistency with it and starting to get lists or, you know, do some different things to like start looking for those customers because you're starting to see some commonalities in the way they buy?
Yeah. So we probably started that process after we validated what we believe to be the problem with a very broad set of stakeholders. Because, you know, you could get your first one on with a very single stakeholder, right? Something that you caught lightning in the bottle, you did whatever. But we were fairly disciplined, even at Taleo, RecruitSoft, that before we built foundational sales process and persona-based marketing and all that stuff, we wanted to make sure that we had a very comprehensive set of stakeholders that we validated the value prop with. We validated, you know, how this thing would get bought. Traditionally, we were selling into enterprise market there, so it was large organizations. And once we did that, once we had that validated, then we started building out. You know, we started first of all hiring some people internally. We hired a marketing person at that point. We started adopting a sales process that had battle cards for personas and those types of things. Once we were comfortable that, you know, we'd done the diligence. I think it's really important that entrepreneurs, you know, work really hard to avoid echo chambers. That's one of the pitfalls, is that you can start talking to people, same set of people, or people that have an interest that isn't the same interest as maybe your prospects, and they're telling you what you want to hear, and you're not doing enough getting out of your comfort zone and talking to people. And I've been very, you know, disciplined over the years as we've looked at bringing stuff to market to make sure that, you know, that doesn't take place. And that's been one of the reasons we've had generally successful outcomes as we brought new stuff to market in my organizations, is because, you know, I was always one to say, well, who have we talked to? You know, who else have we talked to? And I think that's a really, you know, crucial best practice to stick to before you go and start building out, you know, your foundational stuff. Because once that stuff, once that's rolling, it's much more difficult to unhook. And your failure in that first year is really, I mean, that's really painful. If you get your first couple, then you don't take advantage of them. So you really have to, you kind of have to be disciplined up front. And that means, you know, taking one step back to make sure you're there. I would encourage people to do that. So,
okay. I think this kind of brings me to an interesting point. Like, one of our kind of core themes at Wildfire is no black boxes. So generally, entrepreneurs kind of fit into one of three buckets, right? They're either kind of a sales kind of leader, they're either a product leader or a technical leader. And I think one of the things we always say is, I don't care which one of those you are, but you have to have some coverage in all of the other ones. And so even if you're a technical founder, you need to have some exposure and understanding how the sales goes. There's a group that we worked with that basically he was a CTO like at a past company, and then basically was a founder. It was a technical sale, but he did the first 100 sales calls. And one of the things I thought was just interesting was the amount of at-bats he got and learning that. And then once he understood kind of what he was looking for, the ability to hire a sales leader in that organization was just so much easier. And so he knew that he didn't do it perfectly, but he had a bunch of good data. And then he understood what he was looking for when he came to hire. And I think that's like such a critical thing. I see so many entrepreneurs that basically say, well, I'm not good at that. I've never done sales. I'm just going to hire somebody and outsource it. And I think early on, the passion, some of the charismatic nature that some of these guys have, the story that you guys bring to like sales is important. And I think like having some exposure to that before you start hiring your first sales guy, I think is critical. So I'm curious about your philosophy, your thoughts on that.
No, I mean, the startups that I've been with, I guess I've been blessed that our founders have been technical, were technical in nature, but they recognized the need to, you know, fulfill that role early on, not just because, you know, they didn't have the money to hire a salesperson. They needed to understand that part of the business in order to translate for all the other people in the organization, right? And I think that was the thing that was critical to the success of, you know, both Taleo and I think Concur early on with the travel piece of it, is that you had to go get other people within the organization understanding why you need to do what you need to do, which may be different than what they were thinking. And if you didn't walk in those shoes, that's really hard. Yeah. And executive sponsorship early on, and somebody that can sit in the middle of the room and play that role, is really important. I think it's just as important, though, as once they played that role, that they have a plan to scale out of the role as well. I think if they find themselves still doing that, doing the same thing they were doing 3 years earlier, they haven't done a good job doing that. I think that's really important, because as the entrepreneurs who are listening to this find out, there's a million things to do, and sales is important, but that's probably the easier of the things to scale in some cases than others once you have it going. So
I just thought it was interesting when you think about Concur. You know, we were kind of priced as the Cadillac solution, and we, you know, over a couple of different pivots, basically changed the impression or the way expense management was really talked about, right? Like, we had kind of the ERP versus the standalone. Then we integrated travel and expense. Then we took it to the web. We took it down market. There was a bunch of things that we were kind of a market leader on, and we were able to keep a premium on our product. And basically, the market continued to move towards us. And I guess one of the things I thought was interesting, especially as I've taken a step back after that, is how much of a moat that turns out to be in your company. And so, you know, I don't think we always had the greatest product all the time, but I think we did have a very good sales and marketing engine that really led and fueled the growth. And so I think a lot of times people think that the only moat I can have is in product, but I think in a lot of cases, sales and marketing and having that engine be very good can be a huge moat that, you know, separates you from your competitors and really accelerates your growth and valuation.
There's no doubt. And I think Concur was a master at reframing what the industry should be thinking.
Right.
You know,
before they knew it.
And that had nothing to do with product. I mean, right. We were selling a lot of that reframing before it was ever in the product.
Yep.
And that creates the moat, right? People will pay for differentiation, and they'll pay for vision. And Concur had an incredible vision on where the market is going, and marketing and sales did a great job of capturing that in their sales process and how they do discovery. All these things that we talked about earlier plays into that, and you get a premium for it. And we you know, as you know, Concur was, We were double most our competitors from a price perspective. Yep. And people were, and we had 98% renewal rates. So people were willing to invest to begin with and to continue to invest. And as you noted, our product was good, but it wasn't doubly good. But but we were able to, you know, continually, you know, be market leaders and thought leadership, which is a value. And I think that's really important for entrepreneurs to have somebody on their staff that takes that's part of what they get up and think about every day, is how they're going to be a thought leader and get themselves out there and make themselves bigger than maybe their company with only 20 people or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah. I think it's even a little bit more specific than that. You just have a different vision about where you think this industry is going. Right. And so I don't really care if it's Property Meld or whatever. I think it's just like saying, and it's part of that challenger sale idea, right? Where it's like saying there is a status quo. We see it a little bit differently, and we can have a great debate on why, but I think whether it's in marketing or in your sales process, I think there's an origin story that these entrepreneurs have, and they see something different than what is existing. And I think that's really important. And I think Concur in particular leaned on that for, you know, 30 years. So I think, you know, that's part of what we've been talking about. But I do think it's a skill that you can bring down to the entrepreneurs, even in a small company, that's saying, hey, look, just because the status quo has been doing this all along, we think that there's an evolution in technologies, there's evolution in tools, there's an evolution in how the workforce is changing. And this is why we think we're going in that direction. And you can do that at almost any stage.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Concur did it every 5 years, right?
Yeah, I know.
Came up with something and reinvented, you know, themselves and, you know, the direction of the market and everything else. So it's a, you know, that is a skill set and it takes a discipline to, you know, have people in your organization that you know, believes in that and willing to, you know, think that way. So,
yeah. So, kind of getting towards, I think that's the last question I had kind of on kind of some of the nuts and bolts of it. But, you know, I always think it's interesting to talk with, sales, folks and just about like maybe their best deal. Like what are some of the characteristics of like the best deal you ever won?
Yeah, I think the best deal I ever won, because it started my technology career, was the first deal I ever sold with Taleo, RecruitSoft, and it was Dow Chemical, and it was really all these things that we talked about here. It was having to go out and find a champion, find a beta customer, get that beta customer converted, make them a raving fan of the organization, and then leverage him to, you know, grow the business. And I've used the experience of that sales cycle throughout the rest of my career. And it was one where, you know, it was my first sale with that company. I was new into technology, but a lot of the things that were utilized, you know, weren't specific to technology. It was more around, you know, understanding what we wanted to get accomplished, putting sure. a plan against that, and yep, then
and executing,
and then executing. So, yeah.
Well, that's good. I mean, it's cool that it resonates with a lot of the things that we talked about in the first half of this podcast. What's the flip side of this though? Like, what's the worst deal that you've ever lost? I always feel like this is interesting too, because there's some like iterative process that good go-to-market people have, right? Where they're saying, yeah. I did some things wrong, I learned from it, and I applied it going forward. And so I'm curious if you had one that you lost, and kind of what were some of the lessons learned? What was the context of that, and what did you kind of take away from that?
Yeah, it was probably GM, and it was with Concur as well.
Lost to Captura, right?
It didn't. No, I'm sorry, it wasn't with Concur, it was with Taleo.
Oh, okay.
And it was
okay.
One where we had Mary Barra, who's now the CEO of GM, this is why it's so painful, now the CEO of GM, she was the head of HR at the time, and she agreed to a meeting to talk about the company. We're still very young, it was in our first year, and instead of running a sales cycle, we ran our CEO out there, and the CEO sat down and they had a great conversation. And then she threw it over the fence to everybody else in her organization, where we had no relationships. We hadn't ran a cycle. We hadn't created a value prop. We didn't understand the competitive landscape. We didn't do all the missionary stuff that you should be doing in a typical sales cycle. And all we did was get them to an RFP that we lost because we had no
context.
We hadn't built any other stakeholder loyalties, nothing. And it was just so painful because it was right there for us to win.
Yep.
And we skipped steps. And that's that happens. You get those meetings more often than not when you're very young, because you got, you know, that's the network CEOs running, and founders know people, and they have, you know, maybe their PE firm had or a VC firm hooked them up with somebody, and they sure. run to it. And I encourage everybody to, you know, do your best to run a cycle in those instances as well, because in a lot of cases you'll get that first conversation, then you can't figure out why it died. Well, it died because you forgot the other part.
So you're saying like still do the conversation with the CEO and whoever senior, just run a parallel process to do all the discovery value proposition,
yes.
build the network. So it's not one or the other. It's just basically, if you're going to do it, don't just rely on the senior relationships,
yes.
do the tough work. Yeah.
I
think that's a good,
you should always
good
take
one.
Take the senior thing if you can get it, but you can't rely on it. So,
That's a good one. Well, good. Maybe the last question I have for you, you know, it's like you've been in this 30 plus years. You've had some amazing success. What would be three things that you think you've really learned that have been kind of a core across that kind of spectrum?
Yeah. So I would say great ideas come from anywhere in the organization. So I'd encourage people just build a culture that kind of embraces cross-functional teams that aren't role or title based, yeah. Because some of the greatest ideas and initiatives that I've been part of have been born out of some random person complete in a different part of the organization, because I was mentored by really great people that had a, you know, DNA that we're going to be very inclusive in how we build teams and how we put initiatives together. And I'm a huge believer in that. So that would be one.
That's a good one.
And then the other is, you know, especially for startups, you're going to have so many things that you can go attack. And I would say work with your executive team and anybody else within your ecosystem and agree upon what success looks like on your list. Keep the list defined. And, you know, we had an old boss at Concur, Raj, no more than 7 items on a list. Yep. No more than 7. And I'm a believer in that.
And only, you know, one number one. And only right, one number and one.
And only one number one.
Yeah.
And recalibrate often.
Yep.
So I think it's really important, because you can be chasing your tail playing whack-a-mole if you don't have that discipline.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And then the third is, you know, scale yourself, drive autonomy, but provide oversight. I think people think autonomy is like just giving it all up, but you have to have oversight with it. And then just be authentic. People will forgive and engage as long as you're authentic, and they like working for organizations where the leadership is authentic. And again, I was blessed coming up in 3 organizations where our founders and entrepreneurs were authentic, and it certainly allowed for great retention of employees. It allowed, you know, for great autonomy and growth and all those things that you want. But it's really hard to replicate if the leader isn't, you know, willing to be authentic and open and, you know, all those things that go along with that.
Yeah, let me drill into one of those that you kind of talked about, like scaling yourself. You know, I think both of us have had a long career at Concur, and the day that we started and the day we ended were very different. And, you know, I always kind of joke that I almost had to throw away 50% of what I learned last year and then relearn it. I just didn't know which 50%. And I think that as startups kind of go through this evolution, founders kind of have that same sort of mentality where it's like, last year is not going to be the same as this year, and next year is going to look a little bit different. And so how do you think about scaling yourself, and like what are some of the things that you did to like continue to stay relevant? I mean, you know, in sales, it's easy, right? You have to be productive and you have to deliver, right? And so, but like how you do that, and like whether it's a small team, it's international, it's all together, it's hybrid, the messaging's changing, we're doing something different with thought leadership. Like there's just a ton of variables that happened there, but you in particular were able to find success all the way through it. So how do you think about that in scaling yourself?
Yeah, I did it through giving autonomy was one thing. Okay. So, but giving up autonomy and mentorship is the two things that allowed me to do it successfully. And I spent, especially the last probably 5 years when I had the big organizations, doing probably 20 to 30 cross-functional one-on-ones monthly in mentorship capacities. Wow. And it allowed me to understand, you know, the organization, what was working, what wasn't working, who the really good people were. So when There were initiatives that I needed to staff or openings. I didn't have to, you know, I didn't have to go ask somebody, so what do you, I got this, who do you think? I knew because I did that work. So it allowed me to, you know, have confidence in the organization and only spend time where, you know, I felt was well spent, not replicating somebody because they're already doing a great job there.
And maybe this goes back to what you were saying before. I mean, I think A, it was bringing your authentic self. I think it was bringing a level of humility to the job where it's like, I got to continue to learn. I got to continue to understand how to navigate the ground and the environment around me is changing. I need to change too. I think that is kind of a growth mentality that basically was probably something that allowed you to continue to be successful at whatever level you decided to do it.
Yeah. And I didn't always have it. I had a, Rob Cavanaugh said to me a billion years ago, a guy, for those listening in, he was a Concur executive. And as I was talking to him about, you know, my career and what's working, what's not working, he said something to me that stuck with me. And I think it's relevant for founders in a lot of cases. He said, you know, Jim, it's okay for you to have more than one conversation on a topic with somebody, because not everybody consumes information at the same pace. They're not at the same. So he goes, I encourage you to recognize that and be okay with that and not be frustrated because either you don't think people understand or whatever. He goes, sometimes you have to take the time to do that. And that was really an epiphany for me because it allowed for better empathy and all these other things. So. Yeah.
Well, Jim, that's great. I appreciate you sharing just your experiences and some of the stories of your career and just some of the foundational elements. I think this has been super helpful. I think these are good tactical items that entrepreneurs can take with you. So if people are interested in contacting you or maybe even working with you, like what's a good way to get in contact with you?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn, Jim Malpeed. It's JFM Advisory. Just direct message me there and I'd love to connect, and I really enjoyed this, Todd, and I appreciate you reaching out to set this up.
Okay, well, sounds good, Jim. Well, thanks again.
All right, thanks.